Okay, our next presentation is going to be by Dr. Risa Robinson. She's going to be speaking on mechanical models, methods to generate aerosols. She is from the Rochester Institute of Technology. So.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Risa Robinson. I'm professor and department head of mechanical engineering at the Kate Gleason College of Engineering at RIT. I'm also the director of the Respiratory Technologies Laboratory. My screen just disappeared. My presentation just disappeared. I guess I'm done.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Thank you. So this laboratory was established about 10 years ago from a generous grant from the American Cancer Society, and we currently have no financial interests in any other industrial partner. And my contribution to today's workshop is to discuss the mechanical models for determining electronic cigarette exposure. In my mind, the most important parameter in mechanical models is how the users are actually using the products. We know that the ISO, the FTC standards have been rendered obsolete. That's the 50 milliliter 2 second puff that we used to test conventional cigarettes with. And we know that that standard doesn't even really apply to conventional cigarettes. And so we need to figure out what is the actual use behavior for people who are using electronic cigarettes. The data to date is very limited. We have some papers that, and I apologize if I'm missing some, but my review indicates that we know based on YouTube videos, we know based on questionnaires, and we know based on laboratory experiments, an estimate of what we think might be happening, but the data is very limited. We have no information that I know of how these cigarettes are used in the natural environment. This is a personal use monitor that is wireless and that will permit topography measurement in the natural environment. We have tested this on 23 electronic cigarette users. We sent this home with them for 24 hours, and we measured a total of 295 smoking sessions, 4,723 puffs were analyzed. This was for the blue rechargeable electronic cigarette. We recorded every puff, the date and time of each puff, and from that we did statistical analysis on the instantaneous and mean flow rate, the volume and the duration of each puff. For these users. Here's an example of two subjects, and we notice that the electronic cigarette users exhibit significant variation in their usage. On the left, you can see that this subject tended to take several puffs of short duration during a single session, whereas the subject on the right tended to take fewer puffs of longer duration during a single session. Now, these two were chosen from our 23-subject cohort to establish sort of the boundaries of what we found from this particular cohort and this particular product. We expected that the emission profile for these use cases would vary significantly. So what we have here is our electronic cigarette puffing machine. It was developed in the Respiratory Technology Laboratory at RIT. And this machine allows us to download the actual profile that we measured in the natural environment to the machine, and we drive the machine with a closed loop proportional valve to precisely mimic the puffing profile that the subject used. So it's driven by LabVIEW. You can see here that we have a chamber. My mouse is not working, but that center picture there is the chamber where we have the blue cigarette, and we measured the emissions. Now, we have a couple of different technologies in the laboratory. That one was PIV controlled. We also have syringe pump controlled machines. Those are the type that you can purchase off the shelf. They range from about $30,000 to $50,000. We've tested both of these in our lab and found that the PID controller was more accurate in controlling the profile. We've also looked at Cambridge filters versus impingers versus Mylar bags. We have looked at conventional cigarettes versus e-cigarettes, the different types of electronic cigarettes. We look at, for conventional cigarettes, we looked at mainstream and sidestream. And we gather this, these emissions to analyze metals, carcinogens, pH, nicotine, GCMS. We've also developed this in, on the right here, you can see that the latest refillable cigarettes now have the button on the side, which needs to be activated before you can actually, have emissions. And so we have an automatic, the LabVIEW program will automatically activate this switch, which turns the button on and then allows us to control precisely when the cigarette is activated so that we can compare accurately across brands. So here's a more detailed picture of the topography that we measured. And the important characteristic here is the number of puffs, the time between puffs, you see that it's not consistent, and the shape of the puff. Now, we can mimic exactly the shape of this puff, or we can take an average and do a square wave puff. I think it's important to figure out what is the effect of these different profiles, and we intend to do that with our mechanical models. Now, if you zoom in on actually the puff, if we're talking about figuring out what is a typical profile? What's a typical puff duration? What's a typical flow rate? What's a typical puff volume? It's important to define what we mean by the puff. So if you look at this, you can see that the user took a short puff and then a medium puff and then a smaller puff, just this one that's blown up. So we can decide, well, are we going to consider that as one puff? Are we going to consider that as three different puffs? So we looked at this, and depending on what characteristics you apply to the statistical analysis, a user could, in one 24-hour session, take 3,000 puffs, or they could take 500 puffs. So it's important that when we report topography, that we talk about how the puff was actually calculated. So we looked at that with our data, and you can see here that the selection of parameters will affect the average puff duration. This is a graph of the mean puff duration for each of the 23 users. If you look at user 18, you can see that depending on what analysis parameter we use, he has a mean puff duration of either 2 seconds or 6 seconds. So the inner puff gap, the minimum puff signal for critical analysis, these parameters are implicitly limited by the investigator's choice of monitoring device. In our lab, we can dial in what those parameters are and see what the effect of those parameters are on our conclusion. So we do this parametric study where we evaluate the inner puff gap. We evaluate the minimum puff for a given, the minimum signal for a given puff, and we try to find where do these values converge. And this study indicates that for this particular cohort, it converges at about 4 time steps, or 0.1 second. So we used those parameters to analyze the puff for this particular cohort. So here's a result for the 23 subjects. Subject number 12, we considered the minimum duration case, where it's a short duration, high frequency puffer. Subject number 7 was a long duration, low frequency puffer, and then the rest were deemed in the average. We wanted to know what is it, how do this affect emissions. So we feed this profile into our puffing machine, and you can see that the topography for this cohort affected it, the exposure, increased by 3 times the emissions between the low duration puffer and the high duration puffer. Okay, so this is another study that we did. This one is on refillables. And this indicates that for a given puff, these are all 90 milliliter puffs, for a given puff, it's clear that the puff flow rate affects the emission. As the puff flow rate increases, even though it's the same amount of aerosol inhaled, the actual emissions decreases. You also notice that this the effect of this flow rate is greater than the difference between the brand. There's three brands shown here, Apollo, Halo, and iTest, and there's no significant difference between these three refillable brands, but there is significant difference as a function of the flow rate. This is not, the difference between brands is not so much true for refillables, but it is true for the disposables. This is a study that we did on five disposable devices, Crisscross, Swisher Blue, Encore, and White Cloud. And in this picture, we're showing three data points. The color square is the unpuffed amount of nicotine in the cartridge, and this was all done by GCMS, by the way. The unpuffed nicotine in the cartridge. The white square is the amount of nicotine delivered to the pad. And then the X, the crosshatch, is the efficiency. So this was a way that we could compare these brands, even though they might have been labeled as different content initially. So the takeaway from this slide is that the transfer efficiency is overall very poor with these disposables. You can see in the X is that it's, for most of these brands, it's below 10%. With the exception of Swisher, which was around 60%. The other takeaway is that you could see, if you compare Swisher and White Cloud, for example, even though the White Cloud initially, the one on the far left here, initially has more nicotine in the empty cartridge than the Swisher, because the Swisher is so much more efficient, they actually end up with the same amount of delivery to the user. So we can't rely on lower nicotine content products to actually deliver lower nicotine. So one way to look at this, to assess all of these different designs, is we reverse engineer the design. So we took these cigarettes apart, we measured each and every component, and we drew up CAD models so that we could evaluate what is the effect on all of these engineering designs on the efficiency of the aerosol delivery. So these are the models that we have evaluated so far, and what we're looking at here is what is the effect of the placement of all of the different components that the last two speakers described. What's the effect of their dimensions, what's the effect of the placement on the airflow rate and the efficiency at which we can deliver the aerosol. It's affected by the heat transfer and the pressure drops, and we're looking at all of that with our CAD models, and we hope to somehow be able to predict based on a new design what the emission is going to be and then compare that to what we actually measure in the lab. So we, in summary here, this is the way that we think that we should be evaluating these electronic cigarettes, a comprehensive mechanical model that involves reverse engineering the cigarette, looking at the flow path, looking at fluid mechanics of the flow path. We also think it's important that we measure the actual topography in a natural environment, that we look at how we are evaluating the puff, and that we drive the mechanical models, the puffing machines, with those in-home topographies. Although we haven't started this study yet, it's also important to look at the lung deposition because, as we all know, the size of the particles that are inhaled are going to affect where those particles are deposited in the lung and have an effect ultimately on toxicology. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay, and our last speaker for this session will be Dr. Jonathan Thornburg from RTI International on measurement methods for electronic cigarette aerosol emissions.
Good morning, everybody. It's my pleasure to be here this morning and give you some background information on how to measure the aerosol emissions produced by electronic cigarettes. Before I get into the specifics, I forgot to mention, I do not have any pertinent financial conflicts of interest with electronic cigarettes. I also wanted to mention that any of the photographs or mention of trade names of the commercial available aerosol instrumentation I will be discussing does not mean I endorse those instruments. So the just some quick first some background information from the previous talks this morning. Just to make sure people aren't confused, there's been a lot of discussion of vapors and aerosols simultaneously. Just want to clarify, they are not the same. The vapors are the gases, you know, oxygen, nitrogen, and some of the organics like the acetaldehyde and formaldehyde you're seeing, those are vapors. The aerosols are the particles. So an aerosol is a solid or liquid particle suspended in a gas. Which is usually air. Aerosols are measured typically in the units of micrometers, so that's 10 to the minus 6 of a meter. Sometimes we refer to micrometers as microns in shorthand. As a point of reference, the hair on our heads, no matter what color it is between 50 and 100 micrometers in diameter or thick. So I know as an aerosol physicist and engineer, I will use the term aerosol and particle interchangeably throughout my talk. Just want you to be perfectly clear that they are both synonyms for each other. So there are particles and vapors being generated by electronic cigarettes. I am only going to focus on the aerosol measurement methods. I'm not going to talk about how to collect samples for the vapors, for either real-time or offline analysis. So really, by the end of this talk, I hope you have a basic understanding of the different approaches that can be used to measure electronic cigarette aerosols. So what do we want to measure when we are looking at these aerosols produced by electronic cigarettes? Now, first off, we want to measure just how large are these aerosols. What is their diameter? And not just the diameter of a single aerosol particle, one at a time, but what is their overall size distribution? So that's the combination of all the sizes in the aerosol. And this graph over here on the right, this is the EPA representation for the aerosol size distribution in the ambient air. Here in the United States. So you can see there's, this is a size distribution where there's one peak down here in the fine mode particles, which is less than 1 micrometer, and then you kind of another peak up in the coarse mode particles outside in the air. Just want to point out, because I'll be mentioning this later, remember this fine mode particle peak in the ambient air, less than 1 micrometer. With aerosols, we also want to know how many particles are in the air, and that can be reported two ways. It can be a mass concentration, which is typically given as the weight of the particles or the aerosols per unit volume of air. Typically in aerosol, we report it as micrograms per meter cubed of air. We also can measure the number concentration. So that's the number of the actual number of particles per unit volume of air, and that varies and how it's presented. It can be number per meter cubed, number per centimeter cubed, and sometimes reported as number per cc, which is cubic centimeters, which is equal to centimeter cubed. Important to note, I guess, that when you're talking about number and mass, when you have the smaller particles, you typically have many, many more number concentration of small particles as opposed to mass, because if you assume of aerosol particles as sphere, the mass of that sphere is proportional to the diameter cubed. So the larger the particle, the mass is going to go up by to the third order. So why do we want to know how big these particles are and how many there are? Well, as Risa pointed out, the size of the particles determines where the aerosol deposits in your lungs. And in general, for aerosol particles, if you can see this graph here, the larger the particle, the higher in your respiratory system it'll deposit. So the largest particles, the 7 micrometer particles and larger deposit in your nose. And as the particles get smaller, they go deeper and deeper into your lungs. And down here in the alveolar region where the oxygen transfer occurs, these are where you're getting the deposition of the particles less than 1 micrometer in diameter. And again, the concentration of the function of particle size determines how many of these particles deposit and where they deposit in your lungs, or the mass of the particles that deposits in your lungs, in each location in your lungs. So the scientific reasons for wanting to understand the size and concentration of the aerosols produced by electronic cigarettes are threefold. One, the chemical composition of the aerosol particles varies with the size and concentration. We've talked, there's been some mention of the chemical constituents. The carrier liquid is the, glycerin or polyethylene glycol. But there's also the flavorings, the nicotine, there could be some, metals from that leached out from the heater coil. The fraction of those different chemicals varies as a function of particle size. The size and concentration of the particles also determine the toxicity of the aerosol particles. As a particle gets smaller, the surface area of that particle increases, so it's easier for the toxic components to diffuse out of that particle into your lung tissue. And finally, the user and the user's exposure, as well as any potential secondhand exposure, is greatly influenced by the size and concentration and the composition of these particles. So I have done some research on the size distribution of the electronic cigarette aerosol emissions. From the research we've conducted at RTI, in general, the aerosol particles are very small. They are less than 1 micrometer in diameter. So that's, or put another way, they're smaller than 1,000 nanometers. So if you remember that EPA ambient air quality size distribution graph, these are all these particles. They're very much in the fine mode of the particles, of the smallest particles. So here's just an example of just showing that from two different electronic cigarette liquids we tested on a single device in our laboratory at RTI, showing that yes, the size distributions are typically most of the masses in the most of the number of particles are less than 1 micrometer. So just focusing on these, looking at these methods to sample aerosol emissions smaller than 1 micrometer. There's 4 different methods. The first method I'll talk about is what's called an inertial impactor. So that just uses, you are using the mass of the particle. You're driving the particle into a surface. Just like stopping a car, you want to put it on the brakes for a stoplight. You want to roll through the intersection, but you eventually stop at the line. So in this case, the particles are accelerated through these nozzles, and their inertia carries them, and they deposit on this filter. Or in this diagram, it's called a collection plate. An advantage of these types of systems is that there's many, many different styles, and they're very simple to use. And they come in a very wide range of size classification bins. You can get, all the way down. This unit here can sample all the way down into the 50 nanometer and smaller range. This unit here, for example, can collect a lot of the larger particles, 10, 20, 30 micrometers in diameter. This one here is actually one that's actually designed to mimic the different areas of your respiratory system. So you're kind of, you're looking at your head deposition, upper thoracic deposition, a bronchial deposition, and deep alveolar deposition. So you collect all these, the aerosol on filters, and they're very easy to analyze for total mass, so the total weight of the particles collected, as well as non-volatile components like metals, as Samantha mentioned, using methods like ICP-MS. even though my slide said there's two disadvantages, there's actually three disadvantages with using this type of system. One, mainly the volatile components of the aerosols will evaporate. As the air flows through the impactor, the pressure in there gets lower and lower, so it kind of becomes more like operating in a vacuum. As that pressure gets lower, the more volatile components, especially like the ethylene glycol and the carrier liquids, will evaporate. So you're actually not getting a true representation of the mass that was generated by the electron of cigarette. Because of that evaporation, any non-volatile components like metals that leach out from the heating coil may be classified as a smaller size than they are actually generated by the electron of cigarette. The third disadvantage, and I apologize for not having this on the slide, is that this device is an integrated measurement, i.e. it doesn't provide information in real time. As Risa mentioned, the user topography could have a big impact on the emissions. So if you don't, if there's any change in topography and emission rate, you won't be able to detect those changes with this device. So the second method is something called light scattering. That's just simply count and size of particles by the intensity of light scattered. That diagram is shown here. Easy way to picture that is if you're looking out your window when the sun is setting, and you can see the sun shining through your window, you can see little dust motes floating around in your house. That is light scattering. This device is very accurate and precise. It can cover a wide range of particle sizes, all the way from 100 nanometers up to micrometers. It can classify particles into many different size channels. These particle channels also, in light scattering instruments, also are very good at detecting, collecting a large quantity of data quickly. So this is a real-time device, so this can give you a real-time measurement of the concentration and size distribution. So you can get temporal fluctuations in those parameters. Some disadvantages. There is a lower size limit to how small of a particle can be detected by light scattering. That varies between 100 and 300 nanometers. So if you have an e-cigarette that produces a lot of 50 nanometer aerosol particles, you're not going to be able to see them with these types of devices. In most cases, you need to dilute the aerosol to get a measurable concentration because the e-cigarettes produce such a high concentration. And also these devices require calibration specifically for electronic cigarette aerosols. They normally don't come from the manufacturer calibrated that way. Third, a very simple method is called condensation particle counting. That just uses a two-step process to grow particles in a saturated water or alcohol vapor. Then you count the particles by light scattering. It's another very accurate, precise measurement. You can measure a very high concentration of particles. 10 to the 7th is very, very high. Typical room concentrations are about 10 to the 3rd. And again, it's also a real-time data, so you get a large quantity of data quickly. The major disadvantage is it does not measure particle size. Because you're growing the particles, you're physically changing the size of the particle. However, you can pair that device, the particle counter, with what's called a differential mobility system, which separates these submicrometer particles based on their electrical charge and electrical mobility. Again, very precise and accurate. Covers exactly the size range we're looking for, 10 nanometers to almost up to 1 micrometer. And you can collect, again, a large quantity of data quickly, so you're getting that real-time data. Big disadvantage with this device is that, again, the volatile components may evaporate, so that the measured size detected by this instrument will be maybe smaller than the size actually generated. You also need a very consistent aerosol output from your electronic cigarette because the response time for the device, this type of device, is very slow. And third, for most common laboratories, it's a very expensive piece of instrumentation, and a lot of laboratories and users may not be able to afford one. So in conclusion, the aerosol size and composition produced by electronic cigarettes varies with the type of cigarette device and liquid use. You can get accurate measurements of the total number concentration easily using the condensation particle counter. The size distribution and mass concentration measurements are difficult because of the highly volatile nature of the aerosol that's produced, but it is possible if you operate it under the right conditions. Thank you.
Could I ask the speakers from this panel to come up to the panel and up front? And as that's happening, I'm going to be gathering those clarifying questions before we start in on a more formal. So again, if you're online, send them in via the website, and clarifying questions get to the side. Okay, so one question is a little bit longer. I'm going to add that to the panel since we're going for more clarifying ones. Okay, a lot of conversation so far on what to test and how to test it. Any data yet that is revealing if the tests are valuable and can lead to finding out what regulations should be made now? That's not a clarifying question because that's like a meaty one. So let me come back to that one, okay? What is the range of particle size in normal cigarettes, and how does that compare to e-cigarettes? So who wants to take that one? Sure. What is the range of particle size in normal cigarettes, and how does that compare to e-cigarettes?
Thank you. So I'll start answering that question. So I have not done any aerosol size measurement data directly as emitted from electronic or conventional tobacco cigarettes, but I have done numerous secondhand exposure studies. And from those types of studies, in the sub-micrometer range, the electronic cigarettes and the tobacco smoke cigarettes have very similar size distributions. However, the conventional tobacco cigarettes also produce a significant high quantity of particles larger than 2 micrometers. So there's a very they have a lot of more particles of mass in the higher size range.
Go ahead, Dr. Watson.
I don't do any particle size measurements, so take this with a grain of salt. But from reading the literature and some of the points that Jonathan talked about in terms of the measurement, a lot of the measurements are sort of method or instrument dependent. And so when you're looking at the literature that's been published on particle size from these products, generally the studies are internally consistent, but sometimes it's hard to compare different sort of studies. But from my read of the literature, the particle sizes, as you said, are very comparable between the two types of products.
Okay, now, so our plan was we would do clarifying questions and then go into the questions for the panels. But as all of you may imagine, there is a spectrum of that, and we're just going to jump into the questions because when I look at them, they're meatier than clarifying. Okay, so let's just go on for questions. This is the first one, and actually I'll come back to that one that I'd started with. Question to Samantha Gadd. How do you see the risk of hand picking of nicotine and nicotine solutions in vape shops and by consumers? And the other thing that I'm going to say is that handwriting will matter on my ease of reading it, hint, hint. And as a physician, I will confess I'm not so good at that. So please, print or write very clearly. So how do you see the risk of handling of nicotine and nicotine solutions in vape shots or by consumers? So the handling of it. Does that make sense? So when you're in, if I'm understanding the question, in vape shops or by consumers with refilling it, how do you see the risk of handling of the nicotine or nicotine solutions? What do you think?
Okay, so I guess I'm going to make an assumption that that means particular risk of spilling it on your hands.
I think contact.
Yeah. Okay, contact on your hands. Well, I mean, it's going to depend on a lot on the formulation. There are some nice calculations available through EPA and other agencies which discuss the risk of how to determine the risk of dermal contact. Some of the things that you need to look into with that are not only the surface area, but also the properties of the e-liquid itself. You can look at Henry's law constant, dermal absorption, fixed law, equations such as that in order to determine what may be absorbed through your skin. Otherwise, a lot of it could be rinsed off immediately. I'm not sure if that fully answers the question.
We'll get more if it doesn't.
Okay.
So this one, Jonathan Thornburg. I want to understand what he means by particle size and particle concentration determining toxicity. Two sort of questions came in like that. So what do you, when you said determine toxicity, what did you mean?
So I think toxicity means the physiological effect of the aerosol on your lung tissue, whether it's, there's a lot of different assays for that. I think that's not my area of expertise, and I know there are talks tomorrow talking about the toxicity of electronic cigarette emissions.
Okay. So are there maximum temperatures that should not be exceeded for product components such as surfaces, materials, batteries, and heating elements? So this is open to anyone on the panel. What are the maximum temperatures that should not be exceeded for product components?
I guess I can get started on that one. It would depend greatly on the materials of which the e-cigarette is comprised. Metals, of course, can withstand higher temperatures than polymers. I know some devices have engineering controls, which force them to cut off after it reaches a certain temperature. So I'm not sure that you could put a specific temperature limit on what is safe. It would depend greatly on the design of the electronic cigarette.
Okay.
I'll weigh in here, even though I have no direct, haven't done any measurements. What I've read online is that the typical temperatures are in 100 to 300 C range. And what I've deciphered from reading some of the blogs is if you have a dry coil or the design perhaps, you know, exceeds the manufacturer specs, you can get some sort of like off sort of flavor charring type things which the user notices and then notices it's time to replace the atomizer or cartomizer at that point. And so I think there is sort of sensory feedback if you sort of exceed these limits. Presumably as the things get hotter, there's a possibility you could have more pyrolysis products and generation of some of these carbonyls or other sort of constituents. But I think this is an area that needs more work. I don't think we have a good understanding now exactly of the interaction between temperature and delivery.
Okay. It was stated a few times that as voltage goes up, TPM goes up in e-cigs. Tobacco particulate matter is not present in vapor. Can you please clarify? I think, Dr. Watson, that was for you.
Well, my understanding of looking at the design, as the voltage goes up, the current goes up, you have higher power, so presumably if you don't have any voltage circuitry in there to limit the temperature of the current flow, you know, you get a hotter temperature, which in theory vaporizes more of the solution, which in turn then condenses into the aerosol that the user inhales. So since Again, my understanding is that the nicotine in these devices come from extracts of tobacco plants. You do get some extract of some other constituents in addition to the nicotine, and these would be presumably, particularly the more volatile, semi-volatile ones, would be evaporated and getting into the trying to keep my terminology straight so I'm in trouble down here with Jonathan. So transfer into the vapor and then into the aerosol. And so at higher voltage, at higher temperatures, presumably you get more transfer from things that are native in the solution, as well as the possibility you can get sort of thermal decomposition products generated as well.
Okay.
I hope that answers the question.
Dr. Robinson, what was the experience of the e-cigarette users in your study? So how experienced were they in using e-cigarettes in your study?
We limited it to users who had been using it for at least 3 months.
Okay, at least one of the schematics of e-cigarette design suggests that some models employ side stream ventilation holes. Is this a common design feature? If so, what are the implications on the reliability of standardized aerosol emission measurements methods as a surrogate measure of user exposure delivery, i.e. fingers over the holes? So does any, I'm puzzled by that question because I didn't know e-cigarettes had the ventilation holes. So.
Yes, they have holes on the sides to allow for the airflow through them. I have seen many designs where the holes are on the side. I'm not sure how often they would be occluded by the user. I would assume that would be pretty easy for the user to figure out that they're not actually inhaling any aerosol. I'm not sure how that might impact smoking machine design and aerosol particle measurements. Because the aerosol should still be coming directly out of the device.
Anyone else want to touch that in testing for the aerosol?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm not sure I completely understand the question.
Okay, so some models have side stream ventilation holes.
Some e-cigs or the regular, like, low-yield conventional? It sounds like they might be referring to the low-yield conventional cigarettes where they put the ventilation hole in the side to make it so that you had theoretically less yield, so you're diluting the smoke.
Yep, and what models, though, so e-cigarettes.
Right, the ventilation holes in electronic cigarettes are basically the flow path to allow the air in. It's not really comparable to the conventional cigarettes where they had the ventilation holes to try to dilute the smoke so that the user would get less exposure. So there's really no comparing the two. If the user were, and so what they found with compensatory behavior in conventional cigarettes was that they would block the ventilation hole so that they could still get their same hit. And it sounds like what this question is referring to is what happens if they block the ventilation hole in the e-cig. And if that happens, they're not going to get anything. There's no airflow. So,
measurement issue too. Okay. Let me come back to this is a question I had from the beginning. A lot of the conversation so far on what to test and how to test it. Any data yet that is revealing if the tests are valuable and can lead to finding out what regulations should be made and why?
I'll take that one. I think it's. I think we're not very close yet to figuring out how these cigarettes are supposed to be tested. I think we need more information on, you know, what the how the user is actually using the cigarette. In the past, we used the FTC protocol, which was the 50 milliliter 2 second puff, and you know, we used that protocol for 30 years. And unfortunately, the data that was gathered, you know, millions of dollars expended on useless data now because we can't refer to that for what the exposure is in conventional cigarettes. And I think we need to really look at how the users are using these cigarettes, and we need to drive the regulation and the testing based on actual use.
Anyone else want to?
Sure, I'll weigh in. Coming from a product testing laboratory, of course, I would say product testing is useful. And the utility right now, I would say, is basically comparing product designs, trying to understand, you know, how these products work and what design features are important, as opposed to, at the moment, looking at sort of what the delivery sort of on machine testing, how that would translate to an end user. As in cigarettes, I mean, it doesn't translate well at all. Whether or not for e-cigarettes, as more and more studies come online, looking at topography and how people actually use the device, whether we see, you know, a pattern of exposure or several different patterns of exposure depending on the type of user or the experience of the users, I mean, that could sort of shape the discussion moving forward. But right now, I'd say it is useful to have standardized testing, just basically to help to compare product designs and look at sort of deliveries, or one can think of sort of maximal deliveries you can get out of these type of devices to sort of set sort of upper exposure estimates if that's the type of work you're doing. There does seem to be some consensus. I was at the recent TSRC. A lot of people seem to be zeroing in on like a 3-second puff duration. I can't remember the volume. It's fairly large, and the puff interval is fairly short. But there did seem to be some consistency. Where this is coming from, I don't know. Just people are just following one or two papers out there in the field, or they have some topography, average topography data they're drawing from. I'm not sure yet. But I do think that this is an area that needs to be discussed further and further explored. But just from a product testing standpoint, it is useful right now to just compare product design and get an idea of what factors are important in terms of overall delivery.
Jonathan?
So from the emissions measurement perspective, in my opinion, there is more method development required because the chemical composition and the electronic cigarette emissions are so much different than the conventional combustion tobacco emissions. And the main driver of those big differences is that the e-liquids come in these very large percentage, or a vast majority of the vapors and aerosol particles generated are the solvents, the glycerins and the glycols.
I'd like to also agree with everyone else here that one of the most important things we need to determine first is how the devices are used by a typical user. Determining the exposure to that user, but also it's going to be important how the design of these devices is regulated. I know we haven't really gotten much into modification of devices, but there's a whole other world out there of people who can modify devices and use them in ways other than what is initially intended. And that's going to be really hard to control. So, if there's going to be some regulation coming out on that, I'm not sure, but I think that would probably have to be a good starting point. And, what are you allowed to market as an e-cigarette before you can determine how to evaluate its safety? And then also, as was just mentioned, we need to know what we're looking for. It's quite possible that the harmful compounds are not the same harmful compounds that we would find in regular traditional burn-down cigarettes. And we need to make sure that the test methods that we use are able to measure the harmful compounds.
Okay, thank you. All right. From the information presented so far, which design parameters, battery power, coil design, liquid composition, wick design, etc., have the greatest impact on the delivery of nicotine?
I mean, I guess I would say just from a purely mechanical fluid mechanics point of view, it's an aerosolization process, and so you need to put energy into the liquid to convert it from the liquid to an aerosol. So the more energy put in, the more aerosol delivery. And so that logic lends itself to the battery power as being one of the major factors.
Anybody else want to?
I'd agree also the battery. We saw some of the basic physics calculations that the more energy you get, the more power you're going to put into it, the more nicotine, aerosol, vapor, the more compounds you're going to get out of the e-cigarette. So that probably has the biggest impact.
Okay. Like stepping on your toes here. But again, being a chemist, not an engineer, presumably Ms. mentioned sort of the generation of the aerosol, but I don't know, you know, what goes into the design of the cartomizers, atomizers, but if you can engineer those to deliver sort of a uniform, smaller size distribution, presumably you get more efficient transfer of materials such as nicotine into the lungs. So I'm thinking sort of the power and design and the airflow channels that might affect the flow rates and delivery and condensation of physics presumably are very important.
Well, and you also have the device design, but you can't forget about the chemistry of the e-liquid itself. I mean, the graph I showed was two different e-liquids, almost identical ingredients on the labels, but they were visibly two different colors. And you can see the size distribution was completely different. And the chemical analysis we did says there was a lot of different trace organic differences in those two liquids that caused a different size distribution. So definitely the chemistry of the e-liquid is going to be important too.
So I didn't hear one answer. Okay. Has research identified specific design features as greater potential sources of risk than others? So specific design features that have greater potential of risk.
I would say no, we don't have that information yet.
Okay. So it could be any parameter, and we can't say which one's going to be greater than the others.
Yeah, I don't know if any of the actual design parameters, personally my greatest concern are user-modified devices, which is not a standard design feature, but people actually going in and tampering in order to adjust how much product they will receive.
Okay. Interchangeable parts and increased consumer control increase the ability of consumers to configure high-power devices. What type of hazard could this present to the consumer? I think that follows up on what you were just saying. Anything else?
User-modified devices can allow for much greater, longer inhalations. Also, you could be making completely different, you could be creating a completely different composition than what's intended by having a higher power or a higher temperature go through, be inhaled. Not sure if that answers completely, entirely.
Yeah, and I'll step on Samantha's toes this time, but her presentation is very interesting, and a lot of things I haven't really considered from an engineering point of view, but you know, if these devices are engineered with certain, you know, specifications, so certain components which are compatible in, you know, the manufacturer's original design, and then the end user has a chance to sort of mix and match these things after the fact, they may end up with situations where the chemistry or the composition of the devices really aren't as compatible as one would like, and you could end up with this. One could end up with a situation where you're creating, I don't want to say more harmful, but you can create unintended consequences, perhaps.
I guess two things that come to mind talking about this are, you know, a lot of the standard e-cigarettes look alike. If somebody were to take a cartridge from one brand and try and use it in another brand, I can't even begin to think about what the impact might be, but also different strengths of e-cigarettes. I'm not sure if, you know, the certain brand I use has a zero nicotine, has a low nicotine, a high nicotine, a menthol, and they're coated by different colors, and I'm not sure if me using a cartridge with a high nicotine in the rechargeable portion that is intended to be for zero nicotine, I don't think that would have any impact, but that's just the certain type I use. I'm not sure, you know, how it would go if people progress and try and quit smoking using these and go from different strengths within the same product. I'm not sure how they might be designed if one rechargeable portion would be designed appropriately to be used with multiple strengths. Or even with, you know, different flavorants as people do the refillable cartridges. I'm not sure how well those are going to work with off-brand or different brand e-liquids.
Okay, sort of a follow-up on that. It was reported that an e-cigarette packed in a passenger's checked luggage started a fire, burning a hole in the luggage. What design safety features could prevent this type of incident?
I had not heard about that, but it sounds like it was a problem with a battery. It would be my guess. And that kind of gets into the previous question, which is the user modifications and causing risk. If you try to install a different battery for longer battery life or you get the higher voltage, you could be causing the battery leakage, cause acid fires, acid burns, things like that.
Again, not our area of expertise, but just as a person has a lot of electronic gadgets in my briefcase and a lot of different types of batteries, I have noticed that certain airlines are sort of very persnickety about lithium-ion batteries. I don't really know what the risk of those are, but I do know that maybe this is the reason why. I haven't heard of any instance with these, but maybe different battery types might be more prone or maybe need different handling conditions.
All right. What is the impact of product aging on hazards such as leaching or particle deposition? So how about the aging? You talked about the shelf life.
That's a very interesting problem that, as I mentioned during my talk, I think is important to evaluate the shelf life of an e-cigarette, the shelf life of the e-liquid, and what might happen between the two over longer periods of time. Everybody knows that things degrade. A typical rubber band is going to, it's not going to be elastic after a certain amount of time. Well, this happens with all polymers. There are certain compounds that are used in some polymers to avoid allowing that to happen. And with many different designs of e-cigarettes and different compounds used in those, either in the cup or whatever kind of wick or material holds the e-cigarette, we have no idea what's going to happen over time, and I think it's very important to evaluate that. It would probably be very expensive to do testing, at T equals 0 and T equals 2, so that's something where I think possibly a method like FTIR to compare the differences over time and just see if they are equivalent or equal. If you have an equal profile at T equals 0 and T equals 2 versus doing an entire range of testing may be an option on how to evaluate that. And I definitely think it's something that needs to be evaluated, again, especially because these do get exposed to extreme temperatures, whether hot or cold.
On the aerosol generation side, we have tested one device repeatedly up to thousands of puffs, and we did see a change in the aerosol size distribution as the device was being used over time. So there was some, we don't know why, but there was some mechanical change in the device itself after repeated use.
Right, and so I would like to add that we know this after we did several thousand puffs that, you dissect and you look at the coil and you can see that it's gunked up and it's degraded.
So that was a follow-up question. What would be some of the strategies to assess aging? Any suggestions on strategies?
I don't know if I have specific suggestions for addressing aging. I know for both mostly pharmaceuticals, but also for medical devices, you can accelerate aging and do accelerated aging testing. So you don't actually have to wait 2 years or whatever the shelf life of your device is in order to get it to evaluate over time. I think some methods for evaluating that could be just comparing a spectra of beginning and, an accelerated or an age testing and see what the differences are. There's all sorts of test methods, obviously. GCMS is popular for some things, also for composition, but you not only have to look at the materials and the e-liquids, but possibly even different formulations, which is Well, I think it'll be important to find a simple comparative method to not be cost prohibitive, but evaluate over time what impacts the different e-liquid formulations may have. And it also may be important to add expiration dates to e-cigarettes or to cartridges in a more obvious manner or on the device itself, so a consumer has it, so it's not on the package that they threw in the trash, you know, a month ago.
Dr. Robinson, this is a question back to you on your study. Were your users dual users or using e-cigarettes to quit traditional cigarettes?
We had, I believe, three of them were dual users, admittedly, but they were not permitted to dual use during the study. The rest of them were sole e-cig users.
Okay, so here's a question going to, what's the potential information collecting capabilities of current devices? So what's the potential benefits and concerns associated with software, data collection, and electronic communications that are occurring with e-cigarettes? Anyone want to? No one brought that up during their presentation that I heard, but any comments on that?
Maybe repeat the question and try to rephrase it.
Okay. What's the potential information collecting capabilities of these electronic devices? They can collect and transmit information. What's the potential benefits and concerns associated with such collection and transmission of information?
It sounds like the question is about the device itself recording like location data or flow rate data.
Yes.
At the moment, we were looking at, I hope this addresses the question, but we're looking at the eye taste and the unit and looking at how we can incorporate our topography device right inside the eye taste, and also looking at ways that you can use the blue chip technology to record smokers who are trying to quit or cut down. You could talk about their feelings or if they're trying to cut down, do they feel like having a cigarette or do they feel like having an e-cig, and then recording that somehow on the device. So we're looking at youth behavior and
I do think it could be hugely beneficial for evaluating consumer usage patterns to determine if it is a type of software that is able to record usage patterns such as length of puff, puff frequency, puff duration, and factors such as that that might aid us in determining what the average user profile is and what exposure may occur based off that average of the typical user. I don't know any possible off the top of my head negative things. I know in some other devices they worry about people hacking and modifying the use. I'm not sure if that would be a concern with e-cigarettes, that somebody would be able to send information into the software that could possibly, you know, hack the software of an e-cigarette and cause it to work differently.
I mean, there's not really any software necessarily in there, so that's why I think we're confused about the question, but there certainly is enough room in these devices that we could add software and blue chip technology if we wanted to do some tracking.
I think some of the devices are microprocessor controlled, so presumably are tracking some sort of data, and I think, as Samantha mentioned, I mean, that could be very useful if you could actually download the device, it would store its own sort of topography. There are useful research implications for this. I've never seen this, but I keep hearing these anecdotal reports that there are devices that can communicate either to other devices or presumably in the future maybe to social media, and what the social implications of those are right now, I have no idea, but it could be important moving forward.
Okay. All right. So that completes our first panel and session. Thank you very much for the speakers and the panelists. There will be a 15-minute break. The kiosk and bathrooms are out that door and around to your right, and we will start at 10:15. Thank you.